Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. On this week's episode, we're back to the interesting topic of exploring the history of the legends surrounding King Arthur. This is the third installment in this show about the legendary King of the Britons. Previously, we looked at the historical figure Lucius Artorius Castus and the most likely historical figure Ambrosius Aurelianus, and how those two men may be some sort of historical basis behind the stories of King Arthur. Today, we'll be looking at two more contestants for that role. The first will be a king named Riothemus, who was likely a king of the Celtic Britons, or possibly a king of a Celtic tribe in northwestern Gaul, aka northwestern France. The second is an Irish prince named Artur MacAidan, the son of an Irish king ruling in a kingdom that held lands in both Ireland and Scotland. As far as the legendary Arthur goes, we've also made some decent headway into his journey. I did a full overview of his life back in episode 10, so listen to that episode if you need a refresher on who this guy is. I've also gone into the specifics about how Arthur pulled the sword from the stone and was crowned as king, and I covered a story about how Arthur decided to fight against the Roman Emperor and become Emperor of Rome himself, and then kinda just didn't do anything with that power. Well, this is episode 3 of Arthur, and unfortunately for me, probably the last one of these I'll be doing. So with that said, it's only fitting that in this episode, we learn about the end of Arthur's life. So without further ado, let's take a jump not into history, but into the legends of King Arthur Pendragon in Out of Legends, King Arthur, Part 3. The following is an excerpt from La Morte d'Arthur by Thomas Malory. Jesu mercy, said the king, where are all my noble knights become? Alas that ever I should see this doleful day for now, said Arthur. I am come to mine end. But would to God that I wist where the traitor Sir Mordred that hath caused all this mischief. Then was King Arthur ware where Sir Mordred leaned upon his sword among a great heap of dead men. Now give me my spear, said Arthur unto Sir Lucan, for yonder I have espied the traitor that all this woe hath wrought. Sir, let him be, said Sir Lucan, for he is unhappy, and if ye pass this unhappy day, ye shall be right well revenged upon him. Good Lord, remember ye of your night's dream, and what the spirit of Sir Gawain told you this night. Yet God of his great goodness hath preserved you hitherto. Therefore, for God's sake, my lord, leave off by this, for blessed be God ye have won the field. For here we be three alive, and with Sir Mordred is none alive. And if ye leave off now, this wicked day of destiny is past. Betide me death, betide me life, saith the king. Now I see him yonder alone, he shall never escape mine hands. In for out a better avail shall I never have him. God speed you well, said Sir Bedivere. Then the king gat his spear in both his hands and ran towards Sir Mordred, crying, Traitor, now is thy death day come. And when Sir Mordred heard Sir Arthur, he ran unto him with his sword drawn in his hand. And there King Arthur smote Sir Mordred under the shield with a foin of his spear throughout the body more than a fathom. And when Sir Mordred fell, he had his death wound, he thrust himself with the might that he had up to the burr of King Arthur's spear. And right so he smote his father Arthur with his sword holden in both his hands on the side of the head, that the sword pierced the helmet and the brain pan. And therewithal Sir Mordred fell stark dead to the earth, and the noble Arthur fell in a swoon to the death. So how do we get to the death of King Arthur? As with the previous episodes, I'm using La Morte d'Arthur as the canon of these events. Well, it all begins with the fact that Sir Lancelot was in love with Arthur's wife, Queen Guinevere. For quite a bit of time, the two had been having an affair behind the king's back. Eventually, the affair is discovered by Mordred, Arthur's illegitimate son he had with his sister, who he didn't know was his sister at the time, and some other knights. When the knights bring this news to their king, Arthur decides that the best course of action is to have his wife burned at the stake. When Lancelot hears of this, he and a group of knights loyal to him rush in to save Guinevere from death. In the ensuing battle, two of Mordred's half-brothers, making them full-blooded brothers of the great Sir Gawain, are killed. Lancelot, Guinevere, and their loyal knights flee to Lancelot's castle named Joyous Gard. After a further battle between the forces of Arthur and Lancelot, the Pope for some reason decides to intervene and tells Lancelot that he has to give Guinevere back to Arthur. I guess Arthur being Emperor of Rome finally came in handy for something. Lancelot returns the queen and then flees to France with his remaining army. Arthur leaves for France with his army, leaving Britain in the hands of Sir Mordred. The main piece of action in this part of the story sees Sir Gawain and Sir Lancelot fighting against one another. These two were the most important knights in Arthur's kingdom, and almost definitely among the most popular characters for the people reading the Arthurian legends at this time, so this is quite the epic battle. It ends with Lancelot dealing a heavy attack against Gawain, taking the powerful knight out of commission. After several days in which I would assume other people were fighting, Gawain heals up in order to go for round 2 against his former Knight of the Round Table buddy. Once again, Lancelot manages to get the better of Gawain, this time with what appears to be a mortal blow. With the greatest of Camelot's remaining knights taken out of commission, Arthur has no other option than to just lay siege to the city Lancelot has taken control over. While he's in medical care, Gawain tells a woman to deliver a message to Lancelot saying that it's probably too late now to make amends with King Arthur. However, Gawain vows that he will get better, and when he does, neither he nor Lancelot will be killed unless it is by the hand of the other. The siege seems like it will go on indefinitely until one day, Arthur receives a message and quickly realizes he has to get back to England. Meanwhile, Mordred has decided to take over England, given that he's already acting in the place of the king anyways. Part of his plan involves getting married to Guinevere. The queen, who's just been through a whole ordeal and is having absolutely none of this, hides away in another castle. This angers Mordred, who makes a few attempts to retrieve Guinevere. However, his plan has become a bit too protracted, and word of his attempts at a coup have reached Arthur in France. Mordred now receives word that his father-uncle king is headed towards the beaches of Dover with his army in order to take back Britain. Arthur's army clashes with that of Mordred's, and many knights die in the process. However, Arthur gets the upper hand and manages to force Mordred to retreat. While the king is inspecting his losses, he comes across Sir Gawain, who is very much looking like he's about to succumb to his wounds. Gawain asks Arthur to get him pen and paper so that he can write a letter to Sir Lancelot. In his letter, Gawain tells Lancelot that he is the best knight he's ever known. He quickly explains the situation going on with Mordred and begs his former ally to lend Arthur aid. Gawain also writes that he can tell this is his last day on Earth as the wound given to him by Lancelot was too fatal. After finishing the letter, Gawain and Arthur have a good cry, seemingly both faint, and then cry again. Then finally, Gawain passes away at noon. Arthur has him buried at a nearby church. The king then pushes on and fights Mordred for a second time. Once again, Mordred is forced to retreat, this time to the city of Canterbury. Then the two parties seemingly come to a tentative truce, or are at least willing to talk with each other. The night before Arthur and Mordred are to meet, in a half-asleep state, Arthur sees the ghost of Sir Gawain. Gawain tells his king that if he fights Mordred the next day, he will die. Instead, he should suggest that the two armies maintain a truce for a month. Gawain informs Arthur that in a month's time, Lancelot will arrive in Britain with an army that will be able to help defeat Mordred. And so Arthur and several representatives from his side meet the next day with Mordred and representatives from his army. All seems to be going well until a snake randomly slithers out of a bush near one of the representatives. The man draws his sword, which immediately frightens everyone in the area, leading to an all-out battle, the Battle of Camlann. We then get into the passage I read. Arthur and Mordred fight. After severely wounding Mordred, the king's son manages to land a mortal blow on the king before dying. Only two of Arthur's knights of the Round Table are alive by the end of the battle, which was a victory for King Arthur, who is still not quite dead. One of the knights, Sir Lucan, is tasked with stopping random villagers from pillaging the remains of the dead knights. The other, Sir Bedivere, helps Arthur to a place where the king can safely rest. Then, Arthur gives Bedivere an astonishing request. Take his sword Excalibur and throw it into a nearby lake. Bedivere goes to the lake but doesn't want to throw away Excalibur, so he hides it away and returns to his king, lying about having completed the task. When Arthur asks him what he saw, Bedivere replies that he only saw the lake. Arthur scolds him and calls him a liar. So Bedivere once again goes to the lake but refuses to toss in the sword. The same outcome happens again, and Bedivere goes to the lake for a third time. This time, he actually throws the sword. Before it hits the water, a hand reaches out from the depths and grabs the sword. It's the Lady of the Lake, the woman who bestowed Excalibur to Arthur all those years ago. The hand returns into the water, taking the sword. Bedivere returns to Arthur's side and tells him what he saw. Arthur is satisfied but recognizes that he's about to die. He asks Bedivere to take him to the lakeside. When they arrive, they are met by a boat of women. One of the women is Arthur's sister and sometimes enemy, the sorceress Morgan Le Fay. Bedivere is told that Arthur is being taken to the mystical island of Avalon, where he will be healed of his wounds and return when Britain needs him most. However, the next day, Bedivere finds a hermit who tells him Arthur has actually been buried in a nearby church. Despite this, rumors persist that Arthur is not quite dead and will one day return. And thus ends the story of Arthur Pendragon, King of the Britons. Okay, let's finally get into some real history. First up in our two candidates for King Arthur is the Celtic King Riothamus. Our setting for Riothamus's history is fairly similar to that of Ambrosius Aurelianus, as both men were said to live in the 5th century CE. This was a time in which Rome was backing out of Roman Britannia in order to settle matters back on the home front, meaning that the local kings were left woefully unprepared for invasions from Germanic tribes like the Angles and Saxons. However, a part of that history I haven't quite touched on in these Arthurian episodes is the people known as the Bretons. The Bretons were people from sub-Roman Britain who left their homeland due to the Germanic invaders and settled in northwestern France, which back then was known as Armorica, a location I brought up in the first Arthurian episode when talking about Lucius Artorius Caxias. In modern times, the Britons are considered part of the 6 Celtic nations, with their region in France being called Brittany, sometimes also called Little Britain. Like many people considered to be the basis for King Arthur, much of Riothamus' life is basically unknown. For Riothamus, this is especially hard because we don't even know where he was from. The oldest recorded histories of Riothamus come from an Eastern Roman man named Jordanus who just calls Riothamus a king of the Britons. However, during this time, this could either mean someone from Britain or Brittany. The problem is further exacerbated by there having been a Breton prince named Riotham, though this figure and Riothmus were probably not the same guy. But why is Riothmus important, regardless of where he's from? Well, we know that he actually existed, which is more than can be said for some candidates. In the mid-5th century, the Bishop of Clermont in France wrote a letter to Riothmus, asking him to aid a friend whose slaves had been stolen by a group of Bretons. This letter paints Riothmus as a figure who is worthy of settling a dispute like this, which in that time was a very big deal. However, Riothmus' true claim to fame is his leadership in a battle against the Visigoths, a Germanic tribe who flourished around the collapse of the Western Roman Empire and set up their own kingdom in southern France and eastern Spain. According to Jordanus, Riothmus gathered up an army of 12,000 soldiers and sailed to Gaul to fight the Visigoths. His use of the word sail would very much make it seem that Riothmus is coming from the island of Britain, thereby making him a British king and not a Breton king. Riothmus was once again requested to deal with this conflict at the request of the current Roman emperor, Anthemius. Once again, we are seeing someone consider Riothmus a competent enough figure to request aid from. It also brings into question whether Riothmus was a man who would have considered himself a Roman citizen or not. Whether it was Britannia or Armorica, Riothmus was from a nation Rome had conquered centuries beforehand. Was this a client king performing his duty or a man who Rome felt they had to reach out to? Anyways, around 470 CE, Riothmus led a massive army into Armorica in order to fight against the king of the Visigoths, Euric. And things quickly went to hell. Euric became a king of the Visigoths in southern Gaul in the 460s. He succeeded in overthrowing other Visigothic rulers until he became the first king to rule over a united Visigothic kingdom out of Gaul. He also took advantage of the state of the Roman Empire, which Euric viewed as weak due to the relatively quick turnaround for imperial rule, and started pushing his armies into the Roman province of Hispania, taking some of the land for himself. The Roman Emperor Anthemius was very much not keen on losing that land. He had just gotten out of a failed military campaign against the Vandals in northern Africa that resulted in Rome losing that territory. So he called upon Riothmus, a man who had already proved his strength with that earlier military campaign to retrieve slaves. Riothmus arrived in central Gaul with his army, only to be met with the Visigothic army led by Euric, which Jordanus describes as innumerable, which I'm assuming means much, much larger than Riothmus's 12,000 soldiers. Riothmus quickly found out why Euric had been able to expand his power so far as the Visigoths killed a great number of his men, forcing the king of the Britons to retreat before any Roman assistance came his way. He fled northeast into the land of the Burgundian tribe, who were a Germanic tribe loyal to Rome. This allowed Euric to further expand his reign. By 475, the king of the Visigoths had amassed enough power that he forced Rome to recognize his kingdom as independent from that of the empire. And as for Riothmus? Well, we don't really know what happened to him after that horrific defeat in 470. For all intents and purposes, he was probably killed when Euric pushed further. But here's the kicker of the battle. It is highly likely that Riothmus had been betrayed by a member of the Roman military. Euric received word of an approaching army by a man named Arvandus, who was the Praetorian prefect of Gaul and had military power over Gaul, Hispania, and southern Britannia. Arvandus had been widely hated around this time, possibly due to this very event. Arvandus was also very likely a supporter of the Visigothic cause, despite being a high-ranking Roman official. But now on to why Riothmus might be heavily linked with Arthur. Well, first and foremost, he was called King of the Britons around the time we know the earliest King Arthur stories were being written. Despite being defeated in the end, Riothmus was almost certainly a decent military leader with a strong connection to Rome, something that he very much shared in common with Arthur, who would become Emperor of Rome himself. Second, the betrayal of Riothmus by Arvandus has been suggested as a possible inspiration for Mordred's betrayal. Finally, Arthurian historian Geoffrey Ashe makes a claim that before disappearing from recorded history, Riothmus was last sighted in the Burgundian town of Avalon, the similarity to the fictitious Avalon being very on the nose there. Unfortunately, Ashe is the only source that seems to note the Avalon connection, so where he got that is anyone's guess. Also, Riothmus may not have actually been this historical figure's name. Okay, it probably was, but bear with me for right now. Riothmus is the Latinized form of the Brittonic Celtic word Rigothamos, which means great king. So, for all intents and purposes, maybe that was just a title most others called him. Maybe Riothmus's actual name was Arthur. Alright, next up is a man named Artur MacAidan, Prince of Dal Riata. Dal Riata was a Gaelic kingdom in northeastern Ireland and western Scotland, specifically the land around the North Channel. The kingdom reached its greatest extent under the rule of Artur's father, Aidan MacGavran, in the late 6th century CE. Artur's life is otherwise gonna sound pretty dang similar to that of Riothmus. We don't know anything about him besides one specific battle, a battle in which Artur would lose his life. This was the Battle of Niahi, which is dated to sometime in the mid 590s CE. This battle was between Dal Riata and the Picts, another Celtic group living in Scotland. Honestly, there's not much to the history of Artur MacAidan. The most interesting thing about him compared to other Arthurian candidates is that he was from an Irish background instead of a Brittonic one. However, there are arguments that people make as to Artur being a basis for King Arthur. While Artur may have lived and died after the Battle of Mount Badon, the historical fight between the Britons and Saxons that King Arthur was said to have had a hand in, we don't actually get that fact being stated until a couple centuries later, which is more than enough time for the stories of Artur to have moved further south into southern Britain. Obviously, there's also the name. Artur is just the Gaelic form of Arthur. Other theories surrounding Artur are a bit more far-fetched, but they would make it seem that Arthurian legends originally developed out of more Gaelic concepts, and I find that interesting enough to talk about. First, there's the theory that the sword in the stone legend is actually based on the Leofail, which is the stone of destiny in the Irish language. This is a stone on the Hill of Tara in Ireland that was historically used as part of the coronation ceremony of the High King of Ireland. Arthur pulls a sword from a stone which proclaims him as the rightful King of Britain. That's not too far of a difference in stories, just add a sword and Merlin's magic. These same Gaelic Arthur theories suggest that the Battle of Camlann was named after the Allan Water, a river in Scotland. Cam Allan would translate as Bend in the River Allan, hinting at a location for Mordred and Arthur's decisive battle. However, Camlann may come from the name of the Roman fort Camboglana, which is situated just a few miles northeast of the English city Carlisle. This theory also makes the bold claim that Artur held a castle in what may now be the village of Camlough in County Armagh in Northern Ireland, and that happens to sound a bit like Camelot. Another possible fortress Artur allegedly claimed was the Roman fort Camelon, located near the Antonine Wall in Scotland. Again, that name sounds quite a bit like both Camelot and Camlann. Like I said, there's not a whole lot here, but it is a game of playing around with linguistics, and I think that's a lot of fun. Even if none of it is particularly based on hard evidence. Then again, like I said, we don't actually see King Arthur rise as a major figure until a few centuries after he was said to rule, and that's more than enough time for stories of an Irish prince who was possibly well-liked and fought for his people in southern Scotland to make it further south and become parts of the legends of the Celtic Britons. There is also a possibility that Arthur was a synchronization of both Artur and his father Aidan, who was a prominent king of his time on the island of Great Britain. We will almost certainly never know for certain who was the basis of King Arthur, if the King of Legend actually existed at all. I, for one, will still choose to believe that he's loosely based on at least one of the men I've covered over the course of these three Arthurian episodes, probably most likely on both Artorius Castus and Ambrosius, more so than Riothemus and Artur, though it's possible they played smaller parts later. In actuality, he was probably some minor British king who fought against the Saxons, and his legend happened to come about at a time when people just really wanted a hero. His name may have been Arthur, he may have been Vortigern, he may have been Ambrosius, he may have had any sort of name, and then the name Artorius, which was known to the people of this region for centuries, was then put onto him as the more British form Arthur. Then again, there are other names that have been thrown around as well, though I didn't see much point in covering them. They were mostly just minor kings who are now claimed as Welsh historical figures that lived in the 500s CE. Granted, that is my theory specifically, but I'm pushing for a man actually named Arthur. Maybe I might make a small bonus about them, but there's about the same level of historical knowledge available about them as there was Artur Mac Aidan. So, basically nothing. Still, it's been an absolute joy for me to share my love of Arthurian legends in this podcast, and I hope you've enjoyed them as well. So, for the time being, I'll leave you with the words of Sir Thomas Malory himself. Here is the end of the Book of King Arthur and of his noble knights of the Round Table, that when they were whole together there was ever 140. And here is the end of the death of Arthur. I pray you all, gentlemen and gentlewoman that readeth this book of Arthur and his knights, from the beginning to the ending, pray for me while I am alive, that God send me good deliverance. And when I am dead, I pray you all pray for my soul. For this book was ended the 9th year of the reign of King Edward IV by Sir Thomas Malory, knight, as Jesu help him for his great might, as he is the servant of both Jesu both day and night. Thus endeth this noble and joyous book entitled Le Mort d'Arthur, notwithstanding it treateth of the birth, life, and acts of the said King Arthur, of his noble knights of the Round Table, their marvelous inquests and adventures, the achieving of the Sangreal, and in the end, the dolorous death in departing out of this world of them all. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we're covering a figure who I am going to tentatively say was the last emperor of China. I know that's probably opening a whole can of worms that I'll get into next episode. It's the history of the Xuantong Emperor of the Qing Dynasty, more commonly known by the name Puyi. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.